welcome to episode 10 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Alma.
And this week we will be talking about self-care and mental health, considering, I mean, everything that has been going on in this last week. But I think that I've been kind of sensing, you know, mental health concerns and self-care as a kind of persistent issue. I mean, within, like, people that, like, considering, like, regarding myself, friends, family, and the country in general. I mean, I guess just from a personal standpoint, mental health is something that's not discussed at all in the Black community, really. It's starting to get progressively better, but yeah, I mean, I've just been feeling like really, really inspired to have more conversations about it.
So before we get into just the heavy conversation, we wanted to start off the episode with our shout outs. Mm-hmm. And so the first shout out going to go to Oprah Winfrey, and she got her own exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. And if you don't remember, this is a museum that was recently opened under the Obama administration, just highlighting not only African American history, but also the contribution of African American individuals to culture. It was really cool because you were able to see just her reaction to seeing her exhibit. So just really excited for her and just really happy that she's getting not only recognition, but also being, like, memorialized in a museum.
Yeah, shout out to Oprah, always killing the game. Like, you just, I mean, you can never sleep on Oprah. She's just always doing things.
Yeah.
She's so impressive. I hope to be, you know, I hope to have as much success as she has in, like, her pinky toe at some point.
I know, right?
Yeah. Just give me a little bit. Just let me touch the hem.
Yeah.
Okay, so, okay, moving on to our second shout-out. The second goes to Mariah Parker, a 26-year-old Georgia politician who was sworn in as an Athens Clark County Commissioner in Georgia on Tuesday, June 5th. She was actually sworn in on a copy of Malcolm X's autobiography, which is, I mean, like, really, need I say more? Like, it doesn't get any doper than that. I thought that this was, you know, super interesting and impressive that she did this following the whole, like, Roy Moore conversation at the close of last year, where he said that Muslims couldn't hold elected office in the U.S. because you have to be sworn in on the Bible. And he was like dead ass about this. And here we have this, like, young Black woman being sworn in on a copy of Malcolm X's autobiography. Like, I'm just so impressed by her. She's Black, she's openly queer, a PhD candidate in linguistics, a rapper, and dedicated to transformative politics for communities of color. And so I'm reading this from NPR. So in many ways, Parker had always felt like she was unfit to run for public office. A rural Kentucky transplant who has battled depression, anxiety, substance abuse, she had resigned herself to making a difference behind the scenes. Before running for county commissioner, she worked on the campaign of District 9 candidate Tommy Valentine, according to BuzzFeed News, and worked to integrate predominantly white spaces in downtown Athens as a hip-hop artist under the stage name Lingua Franca. I think I might be pronouncing that incorrectly. So Mariah says, you can't wait for a hero to show up. If you see injustice and you see a need for someone to take action, it has to be you. Some of those past struggles are important for the styles of governance I strive to have. And what's even more badass about this story is that she won by 13 votes. So literally every vote counts. Like, you don't have to be the most popular person. You don't have to get all the votes in the world. You don't have to get, like, some petition with hundreds of thousands of signatures. Like, you can beat your opponent in 13 votes. And, I mean, it sounds like she has a lot planned for Athens. So, yeah, I mean, I'm excited. I'm excited for her. And I'm hoping I'm sending positive energy to her, because I can already anticipate some haters, especially that deep in the South. Like, that's deep. So she's already set a precedent. We already know where, like, you know, where her social, political, like, leanings lie. So yeah, good for her.
Yeah. And also just shout out to her for not changing her image to feel like she has to appeal to, because I think, like, sometimes with minorities or people who come from minority communities, it feels like numerically we have to change ourselves or sell ourselves or market ourselves in a way that's most appealing to the predominant group. And that's not what she did, like in everything from the way that she looks to the way that she is to the way that she inaugurated. It's just really nice to see an example and a precedent for you can actually run on a platform being yourself and people will vote you in.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I didn't even, now that you're saying that, like, it didn't even really occur to me, but she had wore her hair in an afro. And so I guess that, yeah, too, probably made people uncomfortable. Like, I didn't even think about that, but, like, because I often forget that, like, that's such a political thing these days.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, yeah, good for her. Good for her. Like, I think that this is very inspiring for me, especially coming off the back of, I can't remember what episode it was where we were talking about, you know, being in academic spaces and kind of feeling like, oh, the code switching episode, you know? Mm-hmm. And she just said, nah, fuck that. Like, I'm gonna do and be who I am, and y'all can either get with it or get lost. I'm gonna win with my 13 votes.
yep.
You're gonna just feel however you feel about it. Like, I saw a lot of people saying, this is why people need to vote red, all of this stuff. Like, oh, well, maybe y'all should have, and, I mean, whatever. Like, she's here now. She's here to stay, so.
Yeah. So, yeah. Shout out to her. Really positive thing that happened this week that's always great to talk about.
Yeah. Doing great things. Miss Ozzy, do you want to talk about our final shout out?
Yeah. So, kind of following up on our last episode where we talked about Kim Kardashian and her trip to the White House and kind of petitioning Alice Johnson's clemency. And she did it. Like, her and Trump, you know, a lot of people are giving her credit, saying that Trump would not have done this if she hadn't brought it to his attention. She's getting a lot of media for it, been on doing some interviews, and Trump, you know, pardoned her. And I saw a video of Alice, like, being released and being reunited with her family, which was really great. And, like, when she thanked Trump, I was like, ugh, like, you know, part of you just, like, doesn't want things to be, like, positive. I don't know. It's just kind of like he's so terrible. Like, when good things happen, you're like, ugh, I what is this feeling? Like, yeah. I'm so conflicted. But, like, Ebony and I were talking, and we just got to acknowledge that when good things happen to people, if were it not for Trump, she would still be there right now. Right. So the most important thing beyond, like, my pettiness for Trump and whether I think that Kim K, you know, really did as much as she people are giving her credit, this woman is with her family today. Yeah. And that's the most important thing. And hopefully, you know, what she said that she wanted to do, which is to give back to the community, is something that she's able to do, and just wanted to shout out that action. Like, even if we don't feel like we need to shout out the man or the people, like, just that action is something that is worth celebrating.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess maybe we should send more celebrities marching down to Trump's office, claiming that Obama didn't do things, so yes, that he'll...
That seems to be the way.
Yeah. So, like, if we need to say, you know, Obama was supposed to release everybody that's in jail for marijuana-related charges, and he didn't, that may actually get the job done. So, I mean, if that's what's necessary, then, you know, we gotta... I don't know. I guess we got to get it. We got to do what we got to do to get the outcome that we want. And,
yes,
you know, the reality is that he's our president. And so kind of ignoring him and turning a blind eye doesn't get us to the outcome that we want. So, yeah, shout out to Kim K again and 45.
Yes.
Ooh, that is the first time in a year that I've, like, ever
said that. I know. It's a new feeling.
Yeah, it is. Hopefully there will be more to come. Maybe he'll surprise us. I don't know.
We'll see.
I wonder what his base thought of that, though. Like, I would love to hear, like, some of those insights, you know? Like, if they felt... I don't know. I bet there's a lot of, like, yeah, see, we do good things for Black people, too.
Yeah, like, see, he doesn't hate Black people.
Okay, well, wrapping up our shout-out segment, now we're going to transition into our In the Know segment. Okay, so now transitioning into our in the know slash what's being slept on segment. For this week, we are combining those two segments that are usually kind of separated since we're talking about mental health. And our later interview will be about the topics related to self-care.
Yes.
So a new report released by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, also known as the CDC, states that the rate of death by suicide in the United States has risen by almost 30% since 1999. Actually, states with the lowest suicide rates have stricter gun laws. Guns are used in nearly half of all suicides, and ready access to weapons is one of several risk factors. So this is definitely a controversial fact, but, we're taught that, you know, like Zelma and I are taught that we don't really make like causal kind of relationships between two variables, but it does seem that there's an association between like looser gun laws and suicide rates. So New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Maryland, and Connecticut have the country's lowest suicide rates and strictest gun laws. And so, I mean, that association sounds, you know, legitimate to me. Yeah, so suicide rates have increased across gender and geographic lines, but nearly 84% of people, 84% of people who kill themselves are white. And 77% are men. That, like, those numbers are insane. And I was really surprised by them because of how little mental health is discussed in the Black community. You know, like, it's just, like, absent for the most part. I don't think I've ever been a part of a conversation with an adult, like, I don't know how you say this, like, I guess, I mean, I'm an adult, but an adult member of my family, so, you know, parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, or anything like that, about mental health. Like, I've never had that conversation with any of them, and I don't think any of them have that conversation. There's no talk about, like, you know, therapy, you know, talking to someone, I mean, beyond, like, a pastor. That's the extent of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it would be interesting to kind of, I wonder if religion, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, does have anything to do with it, or has been maintaining the kind of low suicide rates in the Black community, because the Black community is, like, one of the most religious racial groups in the country. I can't really think of anything else outside of that. Like, it's, I mean, were you surprised by?
Yeah, I also think because, you know, I volunteer as a support group, as a grief support group facilitator. Mm-hmm. And I know that sometimes a lot of people don't say that someone died of a suicide, even though they did.
Mm.
So I was thinking that this could be underreporting in communities of color, okay, where people aren't reporting that, or maybe even the cause of death is, like, a lot of times people will say, there's a lot, you know, people who commit suicide, sometimes it's not just that, it's lots of issues, and so usually, you know, there's lots of other things at play that are happening with people who are committing suicide, or who commit suicide, and so, but, I mean, even thinking of those things that might contribute to differences and statistics and stuff, I still think that you can't, there's no way to talk away the fact that it's majority white people that we're seeing that this is really prominent in. Mm-hmm. And so I was also surprised. I'm not surprised about the men, because men are more likely to, the way that men and women externalize or internalize negative emotions and distress and anxiety. There's lots of, it's very gendered, and there's lots of patterns. So women are more likely, you know, to express their ways in this way, and men are more likely to express them in this way. And so even with, like, the gun statistics, men are more likely to die, to commit suicide through guns.
Mm-hmm.
And so the men part wasn't as surprising, but the race differences were. And I think one of the points that you highlighted is true about, you know, religion being much more, playing a much, not more important, but just like a much larger role in communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that does suppress people. And so maybe people aren't killing themselves literally and with, like, an action that ends their life, but maybe they're engaging in behaviors that are, like, slowly killing themselves. Because mm-hmm. we also argue that, you know, people who are alcoholics are slowly committing suicide. Like, they're like, you know, we have the phrase drinking themselves to death, mm-hmm. and people who are eating themselves to death. And so we do see that in communities of color, there are higher rates of other things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think that this may be a result of maybe among certain communities, people express and engage in these certain types of things. But I honestly don't think that there are less depressed people in certain communities than other. I think like depression and anxiety is something that impacts all groups, and especially with, I think, communities that have an accumulation of burdens and obstacles, especially in this context. Like, I don't know if you saw this story, but of the dad who got deported and separated from his three-year-old. And he got detained by ICE. They said that his three-year-old was ripped from his hands. And then they put him in a jail because of what we're doing to immigrants now. Instead of housing them in facilities, they're housing them in actual prisons. And he killed himself in the jail cell. Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of like there's just, I feel like maybe there's just not much as much attention on certain communities, and we're not getting an accurate reflection of what suicide and of rates, and maybe there's some underreporting going on, maybe some reframing of maybe this person didn't die by suicide, but just, you know, died by cirrhosis of the liver or something. So I think when I saw, when we talk about these statistics, these are all things that came to mind.
That, I hadn't thought about that, and I think that that is definitely true. I mean, I guess maybe I had been thinking about suicide in a very rigidly defined kind of way, as like an active, you know, like effort to take your life. But I do think that, I mean, there are tons of cases, like even anecdotally, people that I know that know and have been told by doctors that if you continue to drink, you will die, and continue to do it. But I have, I mean, I guess in my mind, I've kind of separated, you know, addiction from suicide, but I do think that there are ways that they could overlap, and that's definitely an issue in communities of color, undoubtedly. So we kind of were prompted to have this conversation given the, you know, kind of more public conversations about suicide in this last week, following the deaths of two celebrities. Z, do you want to go through these folks?
Yeah, so I think it was a Tuesday, Kate Spade committed suicide, and I'm taking this out of a New York Times article, and it said Kate suffered from depression and anxiety for many years. Spade's husband, Andy, said in a statement on Wednesday, she was actively seeking help and working closely with her doctors to treat her disease, one that takes far too many lives. We were in touch with her the night before, and she sounded happy. There was no indication and no warning that she would do this. It was a complete shock, and it clearly wasn't her. There were personal demons she was battling. And then to add to that, you know, she has a 13-year-old. And although she was separated from her husband, he was very clear in saying that they were not heading for divorce. They were just, like, trying to work something out. And just in reading that, what I thought was just that they were saying that this was a complete surprise, even though they're saying that she suffered from depression and anxiety for many years. You know, me personally, I have a major depression disorder, and I've had it since I was a teenager. And depression is something that's not just situational. It's not just, oh, I had a bad day, or I had a breakup, or, oh, you know, I'm feeling really blue today, but it can be very chemical based. So like sometimes for some people, there are things that aren't working the way they should in your brain, and it causes you to have these very, very intense, really overwhelmingly sad moments. And so when he's saying that there was no indication or warning that she would do this, that it clearly wasn't her, just kind of highlights at the type of depression where I think that sometimes for people, there are moments that seem so overwhelming that you're just thinking about that particular moment. But were you to wait a couple of days, or were you to ask them about something something a week or two, not feel the same. And that's just the way that depression works for some people. And so I think that's what makes depression and anxiety and suicide so just difficult and complicated and sad. And it's because it is something that I think just for some times and in some situations it is, and a lot of people were saying like it, you know, in response to this is like, reach out, like check on your friends, like make sure that they're okay. And, you know, a lot of people were highlighting that she was a wealthy woman. You know, she was a designer. She had, you know, she was well known. She was in magazines. Like people knew who she was. She was famous. And sometimes we look at people who have money, who have fame, who seem to have a lot. And we think, what could you possibly, like, you have a lot of things that you should be thankful for, especially mm-hmm. like having a 13-year-old child. And so just thinking like, if someone who had all of that saw as their option to not be here anymore, then it must have been such an incredibly overwhelming feeling. And so when I was reading about Kate Spade and her story and what her husband was saying and what her friends were saying, that's what was coming to mind, is just that, you know, depression and anxiety and suicide as just one-dimensional and in one certain way. And we actually don't realize that it's just much more than that, and it's much more complicated. And it can, sometimes it's accidental, sometimes it's on purpose, sometimes it was sad, and it was a sad way to start the week. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of days later, you know, we get the news that Anthony Bourdain had committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And so this is also from, and this is from a Rolling Stone article, and it says, Anthony Bourdain, the chef, writer, and Emmy-winning television personality, died Friday morning of an apparent suicide at the age of 61. His death was confirmed to CNN, which reports that the parts unknown host was in France filming an episode of the series when chef Eric Ribert, a longtime friend of Bourdain, found him unresponsive in his hotel room. And Bourdain also has a child who's 11. And his situation was that he was like in the middle. They said because he was in the middle of shooting an episode, because he had just been with his friend, because he had just done like a lot of actions that reflected that he was preparing to continue planning, you know, in long-term plans, they believe that this was an impulsive decision and it wasn't one that was, some people plan their suicide weeks, months in advance, and they don't think that this was the case with Anthony Bourdain, which I think also again highlights that depression is not just, and suicide is not just something that some people really contemplate for a long time and really like plan for, which does happen for a lot of people, but sometimes it is just a decision that some people make and we don't know why, and we don't know what led to that, which also highlights, I think, a further problem, which is like sometimes we don't even know the people that we think that we know. And so I don't know, like Ebony, what did you think as you were, I know like you were vacaying out and so you came back and it was just sad news, yeah, about like, oh, this person died and this person,
yeah,
died.
Yeah, I was like, God, like, I miss so much. Like, what the fuck is going on? I mean, so one thing that has kind of occurred to me, I mean, because depression among like celebrity, or not depression, suicide among celebrities, I think has been really pervasive, maybe forever, but I mean, in terms of as long as I've been an adult, like, you know, I mean, just really, like, who am I thinking about? Robin Williams, you know, yeah. Like, they're, I mean, so people that you kind of grow up, you know, knowing and idolizing and things like that. And so I know that a lot of these folks do struggle with depression, but I also wonder if suicide could be unrelated to depression or, you know, some kind of, I mean, any kind of mental illness. Like, I don't, I mean, because so I know that they're saying that Kate Spade struggled with depression and anxiety. There have been no reports like that about Anthony Bourdain. Like, so I'm wondering if maybe it could be a product of something else. I don't really.
Well, they said that he, Yeah, he had admitted and been very vocal about his past issue with substance abuse. Mm. So he was a heroin addict. And he talked about how, and then even aside from the heroin addiction, a lot of people were saying that he drank a lot. They were like, you know, in his show, part of the food that he eats, he drinks, he consumes alcoholic beverages. Mm. And so people were like, was this just his job? Like, you know, a result of his job that he was drinking? But they were like, he also was the type of person that, because he had addiction in his past, he did an excess of everything. So he pushed himself, like, to be excessive. So they were kind of saying, like, he was probably drinking a lot heavier. So I'm thinking, like, was this a substance abuse thing that we didn't know about, mm-hmm. that didn't see? And he was also French, and I'm not trying to say that, like, but, like, you know, Europeans drink more, and it's more acceptable in the way that they drink. And so I know that, but I think you're right. There wasn't a lot of people saying, like, oh, yeah, he was a really depressed. I mean, he had a girlfriend. He had just had dinner with or had just had, like, spending the day with his best friend the day before. Whereas with Kate Spade, you know, her husband was like, yeah, we were separated. We were working things. She was no longer part of her fashion empire. She had sold her name. Mm-hmm. So they were continuing to do Kate Spade things, but she wasn't a part of it. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of like, okay, like, I could see why that would be really tough. But I think you're right. Like, with Anthony Bourdain, it's like, what, trying to figure out what is it that, you know, they were so close to each other. And so a lot of people were writing articles and saying that, like, sometimes when one person commits suicide, it is not uncommon, or when a famous person commits suicide, it's not uncommon for there to be a spike, or for there to be another person who also commits suicide. And so just kind of, not like contagion effect, but just that there is evidence that there are increases in these events after one highly publicized one.
I guess my kind of line of thinking was just that I don't want us, because, you know, the, like you were saying, the narrative, or like the discourse kind of surrounding whenever there are publicized, highly publicized suicides, the discourse in the media is check on your friends, you know, talk to them, you know, see how they're doing and all of that. But I would just hate for us to be missing something by looking only for signs of depression.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that, like, I know a few people that struggle with depression. And like you're saying, it's, well, one, there's a difference, there's a very big difference between people that struggle with depression who have been diagnosed, who are on medication, and people who are not. And so a lot of times it's difficult for a person to even articulate what's going on, mm-hmm. or that there is anything wrong. So how do you even have, or, and if they, whether or not they recognize or feel like something's wrong. So how do you even have that conversation when it's not, when it's something that they are kind of maybe not dealing with, not actively dealing with, you know, it just, it, I don't want us to have like tunnel vision and thinking that, you know, these are the symptoms of depression. This is what we should be looking for among our loved ones. And this is how, you know, you, this is how you help to prevent suicide, and then kind of miss something that wasn't on our radar. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if, like, what the other things are, or what the other ways are that we can, you know, help to mitigate this. Because, I mean, I'm even thinking about last year, like, it seemed like the last 2 years, like, kids, like, young kids were also committing suicide at, like, super high. I mean, it seemed like it was super frequent. I was seeing something about it being reported in the news constantly. And so it's, like, even conversations like that, like, how do parents have conversations with their children? You know, what kinds of questions do you ask? What do you, what are warning signs? What do you look for? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. And I mean, I have a psych background and I work in mental health clinics, and there's very tunnel vision sometimes about, like, this is the checklist of people who are at risk. Mm-hmm. Do they say they want to die?
Yeah.
Do they say that they don't want to be here anymore? Do they start giving their stuff away? Are they withdrawing? And so I liked some people, like, on social media saying, like, you know, the whole check on your strong friend was because sometimes it's not the people that you, it's not the typical, like, loner, sad, always crying. Sometimes it's people who have a lot of shit that seem that they have it together, and then you just don't know what someone's going through. So I think, like, the point that you bring up is a very fair one, and one that hopefully, like, we'll get into in our next segment, where we're talking about self-care and, like, mental health and stigma, which is, like, you know, sometimes some people don't know how to vocalize or even be aware that they aren't feeling right, that they are feeling, and it's not just suicide. Like, we're talking about suicide right now because of what happened in the news, but, like, just overall other things that people deal with, stress, social anxiety, you know, depression as well, but just, like, other things that cause people to feel like life can be very overwhelming, especially when we're exposed to so much, like, school shootings and deportation news and just, like, all this terrible stuff. And so we just wanted to kind of spend some time in this episode to make a bigger discussion around the suicide and what do we do.
Yeah, I think that like, that last point that you made is super important, because I feel like we don't have enough conversations about it. So when someone is struggling, that increases, I think, the likelihood of feeling alone, or, like, you, like, you're the only one going through this, you know, because we don't, if this conversation isn't normalized, even though these incidents are like so pervasive, you would think that we would have more conversations about them, and that, you know, we would try to help people feel less isolated and alone in what they're going through. I think that we still have a long way to go as far as that's concerned. And, you know, even if it's not, it doesn't necessarily have to be checking on your friend to see if your friend is bummed or sad, but just, you know, sharing your own kind of feelings and what you're going through, I think, could help encourage someone else to, you know, divulge whatever they're feeling as well. We are going to wrap up there and transition into our interview with our friend and colleague, where we're going to talk about self-care. So stay tuned.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
Okay, so now transitioning into our What's Being Slept On interview with our friend and colleague, Santi.
Hi.
So we're going to be discussing self-care, what that means to us, and kind of some of the things that we do to care for ourselves. Before we get there, I kind of wanted to give a little bit of, I guess, sort of a definition that I found online that seemed to make the most sense to me. So this came from psychcentral.com, and they say that self-care is any activity that we do deliberately in order to take care of our mental, emotional, and physical health. Although it's a simple concept in theory, it's something we very often overlook. Good self-care is key to improved mood and reduced anxiety. And reduced a ton of other things, too. It's also key to a good relationship with oneself and others. So, basically, just making sure not to neglect the things that make you feel good. So, listen to yourself, like your mind, your body, and make sure that you're prioritizing doing the things that put you in a good space. One thing that they noted on the site that I thought was pretty important is that, you know, there could be a common misconception that self-care is selfish. So I guess I was thinking that everything kind of in moderation. I'm not sure what y'all think of that. I guess maybe it varies depending on, you know, like, if you have people that you're taking care of, or, you know, I guess I was thinking about it just because I don't have kids or anything. So I was thinking maybe in terms of, like, friends and family, like, there could be times where I'm like, I kind of need this time to myself. And then, you know, people get in their feelings and stuff. And it's just like, oh, why don't you ever come out? Why don't you ever do this or that? So I don't know if y'all have had or experienced any issues with that. Does anybody ever call your self-care selfish?
I think that in general, you know, people may think that self-care could be selfish, especially if you're a millennial and you're saying that you're, you know, trying to take care of yourself, because I guess there is a perspective that if you're not taking care of others, then, you know, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing as a family member, as a friend or a colleague or things like that. But really, if you don't take care of yourself, there's no way that you can take care of others.
Right. No, that's, I mean, 100%. Like, I think, I mean, I wonder if people even recognize that, like, if they're, because I know that if I, say, for instance, like, go too long without, I don't know, what, working out, or maybe even watching some of my favorite shows, or, like, eating foods I like, there is probably going to be a change in my attitude. But if I am sacrificing those things for someone else, I wonder if they would even value that sacrifice or care or notice, you know, that like, oh, I took away from Ebony's, you know, fill in the blank time. And so now she's in a shitty mood. Like, does that matter to those folks at all? I'm not even sure.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like being Latina, there's a lot of, and I'm not just speaking like from experience, but also from research, that there's a lot of expectations that you have to like put family first, mm-hmm. and you have to like help family whenever they need it, no matter what,
yeah.
no matter what you're doing. And so there's been just a lot of times where I felt like even though I wasn't able to help someone because I myself was in need of self-care, like mm-hmm. I needed to help a family member out. And then in that case, I like even feel like I would think that it was selfish, but that's just because in that context of my family, it's like, you know, if family needs you, then they need you, no mm-hmm. matter if you're not able to help them. And so that's been like a thing that I've had to learn in my dynamic, and I know among my other Latino friends, is like being able to say like, I'm sorry, I just can't answer the phone call right now and like talk you off a ledge because I am in need of some just like energizing myself. Mm-hmm. And I know that like my mom would probably, if she knew that I was avoiding her phone call on purpose to recharge, would be like, oh my gosh, that is so selfish. But like, if I were to answer that phone call, the help that I would give her would not be helpful yeah. to her, and also would like be hurting me.
Yeah. And probably right. half-assed. Like, you can't give all of yourself when you're, if you don't have the energy, if you're not caring for yourself, then you can't care for anybody else. But I think one, the point that you were making early on, Santi, I think is, was really good. Like, I was telling Zelma earlier that these kind of conversations were completely absent when I was growing up. I've never had conversation with any adults in my family about mental health, about self-care, any of these things. So I do feel like, you know, I've also similarly had conversations with my mom, you know, especially being from out of state, like, or just family members in general, like, when are you going to come home? When are you, why are you doing these things? And it's like, well, I have to, if I'm going home, that's me sacrificing time doing anything else here, you know? And so I think that there is kind of a, there isn't much recognition or understanding of kind of this millennial idea of self-care among older generations. It's kind of my perception.
Yeah.
It's like, what? No, you need to be by yourself? What does that even mean, you know?
That's a really great point. And even the research points us in the direction that, you know, taking care of yourself and all of these like different, what could be considered as health behaviors, or they're learned, they're passed down, we share them. So if we don't practice self-care, we probably don't do it because our parents didn't. And if our parents didn't, it's mm-hmm. because their grandparents didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it looks like, you know, our generation is moving towards this self-care movement and trying to take care of ourselves, it looks very odd. Because we're doing something that they hadn't done before, or that they may not recognize, and it probably does look really selfish because we didn't talk about it, because maybe we didn't have the words, or they didn't have the words.
Right. Something I've been thinking too is, you know, I guess I've been wondering, is like, why does it seem like we are, all of these kind of new things are being discovered or evolving? And you know, something that occurred to me is, like, maybe they aren't new. Maybe we're just more reflexive and, like, you know, able to, like, pinpoint what our, whatever issue that we're having, where, what it's related to and where it's coming from. Whereas I think previous generations just kind of, like, ignored or, you know, just weren't, I mean, and for probably really legitimate reasons. Like, so not taking away from, you know, all of those very real struggles, but just recognizing that some of the issues that you think are normal or that everybody goes through or that, you know, this is just the way it is, are actually, can actually be attributed to things, to decisions that you're making on a daily basis, people that you're surrounding yourself with, things that you're neglecting, things that you enjoy that you are sacrificing, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I mean, I think it, I don't know where that reflexivity comes from, like why our generation is, seems to be so much better at it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I feel like I'm better at looking at others instead of myself. So I look at like, what do they call Gen Z, like the generation after us. Mm-hmm. And I see like for example, people were talking about an app that calculates the probability of you being a victim of a school shooting. And
what?
So,
that's crazy.
Like, that's terrible. And then I saw another picture of this kindergarten classroom where they made a poem about what to do when there's an active shooter. And so I think about things like that, and then I'm like, is it that, like, we're just more aware of how, like, terrible? It just seems like the world is getting, like, I know the world is, like, it has been, you know, even in World War II, things were really crazy, things were really shitty. But I think for a lot of people, you were able to shield, if you chose to, to shield yourself from a lot of the negative things. But I think that with social media and with the news and with, like, just public schools,
the internet,
everything, and the internet, it's just getting harder to avoid seeing, like, these terrible things. And I know that there's an increase in anxiety among younger people. And I know that our generation, the millennial generation, is, like, I think that we're actually the first generation to be doing worse than our parents. And so, and it's because of, you know, the recession that we had in 2008, plus the fact that we have so much student loans, plus the fact that we don't get paid as much as people used to. So I think that maybe literally, like, the environment is different. And so we are just exposed to different types of things that we are just internalizing in a way that is affecting us in different ways. But I also don't want to take away from, like, the fact that there were, like, for real people being, like, lynched and shot at.
No, that's a really good point. And I mean, social, I feel like social media is such a double-edged sword. Because
say that again.
One instance, you're bombarded with all of this information and all of these, like, horrific different types of things for you to view, people getting shot, you know, the school shootings and everything that's happening. But then you also have a space for some where you can go and you can share your feelings and you can talk about what you're going through. So it's like, well, I see it in social media all the time, but then I can also have a space where I can be reflexive and talk to my peers or talk to other people and talk through things or, you know, tweet or what have you. And so it's kind of like, well, I don't really know if social media is harming us or helping us or both or what it's doing.
That's, I mean, that's a daily struggle. Like, every day I'm like, I should delete this shit. And then I'm like, oh, this is so hilarious. Like, let me send Santi this video of these cats.
Yes, all the cat videos. If you know? Social media only had cat videos, the world would probably be happier.
I feel like some baby videos, too. Baby videos leave me very hopeful for the future. Like, I'm honestly like, okay, maybe this, the world isn't so terrible.
Well, then maybe that's your self-care.
Yeah, right. No, I think that that is. Like, baby videos, cat videos, and puppy videos. Those are definitely part of my self-care. So, with thanks for that transition, Z. I kind of wanted us to talk about, like, what we each do for self-care. You know, so I don't know if you have things that you maybe do daily or weekly, or maybe things that you do when you are feeling down or feeling like you need some time. If you do have kind of different things that you do for all of those, like, definitely talk about those. So I would say that probably the most, I don't know, I guess maybe the lowest, there have been two, like, I guess really low points. So the first, like, really low point that I can recall where I felt like there was a, where I could pinpoint a cause was, like, when I moved to, when I moved for grad school. And so I think that, you know, recognizing that I was feeling down about that and feeling away, and, like, being away from family and things like that, one thing that I did was FaceTiming and talking to family, you know, as much as possible. So that was something I was actively doing. Like, even if we had nothing to talk about, like, me and my sister were going to sit and just look at each other. And I think that also during that first semester, maybe I overdid the self-care with food and, like, sugar. Because I was, so it made me feel better, but I lied to you not. I was eating, like, a pint of ice cream at least 4 days out of the week. Like, it was, like, Bluebell, like, helped me get through that first semester. Bluebell is a thing that's only in the South, so I didn't know anything about it.
Amen.
So, like, ice cream is a weakness in general, and that was, like, my best friend. I lied to you not. I also am a really avid moviegoer, so I was going to movies a lot. I still do that now. That makes me really happy. And, like, reading, so I love, like, fiction and fantasy. So I do that often. I also work out. I try to work out every day. Sundays are usually my days off, but I can, like, really feel a difference in, you know, like, my energy level and just generally I can feel a difference if I don't work out for a significant period of time. And that was, I think, something that really affected me or tied into how I felt during the, like, comp process. I think that, like, during that time, I wasn't taking time to, like, eat regularly, wasn't working out at all, and also on top of that, the general stress of that, like, process, that was, like, a really shitty period. And so I, coming off of that, I was, you know, really reflecting and, like, why did I feel this way? What are all the things that I was sacrificing and not doing while I was, like, studying? And so definitely eating, working out, not sleeping well, relying on, like, just caffeine which there's obviously nothing wrong with caffeine, but when I hadn't been drinking coffee at all, and then I was relying on, like, energy drinks and stuff like that to stay at, that was pretty terrible. So I try to kind of avoid those things, and even though I think that the whole, like, everything in moderation thing is super important, because I'm, like, I have a really, really, really big sweet tooth. And so while I know that, like, candy and ice cream and things are part of my self-care, I do have to moderate that and, you know, not go overboard. So kind of watching how much sugar I eat is also a part of my self-care. I think that that's, trying to think if there's anything else. I also go on a lot of vacations, so I think that that's a thing too. I almost forgot to mention that. Like, I just generally have a hard time sitting still. And even, I think, looking for flight deals or looking for vacation deals could also be a part of my self-care. Like, just imagining myself visiting someplace else, even if I don't end up going. Even if I don't end up going, it's like, I would love to be, you know, here. I follow a lot of, like, travel pages and stuff on social media. That's awesome too, and envision myself in those places. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it for me. Maybe something that y'all say will spark something else, and I'll be like, yeah, me too, I love that.
I feel like self-care for me fluctuates, mm-hmm. And changes with every place that I move or mm-hmm. every major event that happens in my life. So, like you were saying with exercise, when I first started grad school in Atlanta and went to Emory, I was working out 5 times a week. Mm-hmm. And that was my self-care. Mm-hmm. Every day I was, after school, I was going to the gym and I was working out. And that took a lot of stress away from everything that I was experiencing. It made something that should have been like one of the most stressful times in my life, one of the most happiest times in my life, because I wasn't doing school. I could just focus on running or kicking a bag or whatever I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved to Houston, it was a little bit harder because I didn't know anybody and I was alone. And so and it was so big and I wasn't used to being in a city so big. So I couldn't figure out where exactly to go for my outlets. So I started falling in love again with Tex-Mex. So there you go. I would eat Tex-Mex all the time because it made me happy. But just sitting around and like, then I eventually found out that sitting around and talking with my friends, meeting up with you guys, you know, hanging out with my other friends and going to lunch like every other day and being able to kind of decompress really made me happy. And then reading, not like library books and things like that, but reading other people's stories on different apps like Wattpad. It's an app where people like me or you, everyday people, can go and write fiction.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and just watching writers like that are unknown develop is like very intriguing to me. Like I love it, and their stories are so interesting. And so I find a story and I get hooked, and then I follow them on social media, and then I can have like a conversation with them, and that's something that takes me kind of out of whatever's stressing me out. And I'm like, I'm gonna read, and then I'm gonna talk to this author about their stories, and it's a lot of fun, and it helps me like have hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely helps me have hope that like, hey, this person is out there like living their life, living the dream, writing, getting their stuff out there, and that's something that I want to do and something that I'm interested in, so let me build a community with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I like to do too.
Yeah, those are awesome, Santi. I'm gonna have to get more details about that app. That sounds super cool.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Maybe join it. For me, I have both, like, because I actually have like diagnosed mental illnesses. So I have generalized anxiety disorder and major depressive disorder. So in the past, I have been on medication, which I found to be very helpful. And now I am not on medication anymore. I haven't been for almost 2 years. So part of my self-care for that is, you know, I see a therapist every week, which I found to be very helpful. I've been with my particular therapist for 7 years. So it's been like very nice to be able to talk to someone who's able to see me in different stages of my life. So that's the self-care I do in terms of for my actual like regimen of dealing with mental illnesses in a way that I need. But in terms of self-care and activities that I do, so I also, like you guys, like fluctuate between different types of activities, but I try to do a dance class. I usually do like a 6 class or something where I learn a different type of dance style that I am not used to. I also currently volunteer. It helps me to not only, I really like enjoy giving back, but it also forces me to do things where I'm not, because I have anxiety, and the type of anxiety that I have is that I imagine all the terrible things that could happen to me. So by doing a type of volunteering where I'm helping other people, it forces me for at least several hours a week to not think about myself. And then just like doing crafts I found to be helpful. So I like knit, I learned to cross stitch, I draw, I paint, I kind of circle and do different types of art stuff. I'm back to coloring now. I got like the adult coloring books.
Oh, that's dope.
Totally, yay. Found
to be really helpful. But yeah, I think that just like switching it up and doing different types of activities where I think what my therapist told me is that, you know, research shows that if you do things with your hands, for me, like in terms of my anxiety and depression, it like something about the movement with your hands is really soothing. And so doing like craft stuff or drawing or writing or doing things like that where you're actually using a lot of hand movement is actually very soothing to you. And so he found that, I found that to be helpful. And then with dancing, with the dance classes that I go to, it's like dance slash like meditation. So there's usually like half the class is stretching and breathing and just kind of like focusing on getting relaxed. And the other half is like learning the actual dance. So I found that that's really helpful. But I also just think that, you know, sometimes one thing just doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have to find like new ways. So I'm always looking for new ways that other people are self-caring for themselves, because for me, I really just need like variation and transitions. And that's what I found that is the most effective. But definitely, like, it's a constant journey to find ways and things that help me feel at ease as I navigate through all these different developmental stages of my life.
Yeah, I think that that point ties in really well with what Santi was saying, as far as, you know, and kind of what I was saying early on, like, the moving from place to place, or kind of just any, like, being unsettled in any way, like, whether it be physically, mentally, emotionally, whatever, like, you're gonna experience points that are, periods in your life that are unpredictable, change is inevitable, so, you know, having some kind of self-care strategy, maybe in your back pocket, or maybe just, like you're saying, getting inspiration from other people is, I think, super important, because sometimes you find yourself in positions or situations where you can't continue to do the things that you did before, and then that can be rattling, and then it's like, you know, to kind of prevent yourself from getting in a, I don't know, like, some kind of stump, like, I think that one of the big things for me too is that I had like a poetry lounge that I had been going to for like 5 years, like all throughout college before I moved. And so initially, like, not having a lounge to go to when I moved here was, you know, kind of made me sad, like leaving a place that kind of felt really familiar and all that stuff made me sad. And so for a while I just kind of sat sad about not having access to that. And then one day I was just like, you know what, why don't I just Google another lounge and like look for, you know, find some place here, you know. And then, I mean, obviously that fixed the issue because I found some, but it was, you know, just for a while I was just sitting and just being like really down about it, and, you know, like, oh, I'm not gonna be able to find those kinds of people and all of this stuff. And it's like, nah, like, just, you know, you might have to tweak some things. Maybe it's not as perfect as, you know, what you're used to, or it's not the same, it doesn't feel the same, but you'd be surprised at how over time, you know, things become more comfortable. So, Z, I see that you had another question here.
Yes. Like, one final question that I wanted to make sure we touched on is just, like, and I'm calling this, like, mental health stigma, but it doesn't have to be mental health. It could just be, like, stigma associated with admitting that you are overwhelmed or not okay or not feeling like you should. Because I think sometimes we get a sense that I'm not feeling like I should.
Right.
And I just wanted us to talk about what we see in our communities, because, you know, what we bring in the podcast is what we see in our prospective communities. And so how that stigma impacts how people ask for help. And so for me, being raised in a community where it was very, very religious, and like, you don't go to therapy because Jesus is your therapist. So kind of like, you know, you pray. If you have a sadness, you pray, which, you know, can be helpful. And it's part, you know, for me, I pray as well. And I go to church with my mom when she wants me to. I'm not going to lie and say that I go to church all the time. But I just know, like, I see in my community that sometimes people don't want to admit that they need help, or if they do seek help, like, they're told, like, just pray about it. Mm-hmm. And although I think that's helpful, sometimes I think that there is more support that could be given to people. And if people felt more comfortable or knew or had more resources to reach out and to admit that they're overwhelmed or in need or stressed or sad, then maybe I would see a lot of the people I know be getting the help that I think that they need. And so I, as a person who goes to a therapist, every time another Latino person, even people in my family, talk about how they could really use someone to talk to, I always stress like how beneficial therapy has been to me. And although like I'm perceived by a lot of people as like, oh, just not being religious enough, or I'm just not praying enough, or I'm just weak, I feel like I have had people who did end up going to see a therapist and have told me how helpful it was that I told them that I go to therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to bring like that perspective from my community of origin as to that's been my experience. And so just wanted to kind of highlight that for people, any people listening that may have been told or feel very pressured to find help in a very isolated way, or like keep it in the family. You don't have to go out beyond and tell other people your problems. Like, you know, don't talk about the mess that we have here to strangers you don't know. Like, sometimes if you feel that you do need to talk to someone else, whether it be friends, whether it be a therapist, whether it be just someone outside, that would cause you to have to disclose personal things that other people in your community might think should be kept private, that if that's what you think that you need, then that is something that you should make a priority.
I mean, I kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, but I mean, I definitely can attest to, I mean, from, you know, I mean, definitely anecdotally, but I can definitely attest to the fact that we, within my family, there's so many pastors, there's so many ministers, like, you know, I mean, the focus is on religion, and we're definitely encouraged to seek out pastors and to seek out ministers and, you know, people to talk to if we're having any issues. And, you know, while that, like you said, it can and is beneficial to an extent, there is a lack of, like, acknowledgement of legitimate mental health issues when you're talking to those folks. Like, that's just the reality. It's like, they're not professionals. And so, yes, you know, they can pray with you, and yes, there are tons of benefits of that, but there are also limitations. So I would definitely encourage folks who do talk to, you know, whatever religious figure in their life, to also couple that with a therapist. Like, I think that,
yeah,
you know, those two together would give you the most benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think for me, it was less of a religious piece and more of something else that Zelma had mentioned, which was, like, weakness, like showing weakness. And especially I feel like in the Black community, if you even think about seeking out help beyond the church, then you're weak for some reason. Showing any kind of like emotion, or maybe suggesting that you have depression or some kind of mental health disorder is a sign of weakness, and you have to be strong, and you have to deal with it, and you have to like go through the motions, and this too shall pass, and you know, all of these different sayings. And it's kind of like, well, damn it, maybe I need to talk to somebody else. You know, maybe Pastor blank and blank isn't enough for me. I definitely think that there's something that in a lot of communities we need to get over, in terms of thinking that, you know, because you feel like you need help, that means that you're weak. I think the strongest thing that you can ever do is ask for help. Because it's hard, you know? And I think that if a lot of people took that perspective, a lot of people in the church, a lot of different family members, you know, I think that we could start to have more open discussions about mental health, and we could start to have more discussions about depression, and we could start to take on, you know, these issues head on. We could start to talk about suicide, and we can prevent a lot of the things that we see going on today from happening to especially the younger generations and everything that's going on with that. So
right. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah. Okay, well, do y'all have anything that you would like to add?
No, I'm just really glad that we were able to not only have Santi call in and give us her perspective, because it is kind of personal, mm-hmm. you know, being open about just feeling overwhelmed and feeling, and what do you do to mitigate that, but also just, I'm just glad to bring up these topics that we might be having private conversations about, but trying to make them public. And so, you know, with these two tragic suicides that we talked about earlier, and with just all the things we discussed across all the episodes so far, we're in episode 10, just finally what everyone's been doing, but wanted to do that here. If you ever feel that you are in a very dark space or that you need to reach out, like reach out to someone, and, you know, you just don't know how much of an impact that will do. And then for everyone, just make sure that you keep all your, you check in on your friends, keep your social connections active, you keep everyone updated, and just make sure that we're all doing okay, because we can't get through this without each other.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And I just wanted to throw out the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. You know, just reiterating the point that there are mechanisms for people to go to. You can call, you can text them, you can chat. Like, there are things that you can do, and somebody cares.
Yes, thank you for that, Santi.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. I love your show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for being on.
Yeah. Okay, Z, you want to close this out?
Yes. So, if you have any comments, any feedback, any questions, feel free to give us shoot us an email at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com. Also, feel free to follow us on Instagram at wokeishpodcast. Send us a DM, give us a like, leave a comment. We love just getting feedback from you guys. Also, follow us on Twitter. What's our Twitter, Ebony?
Wokeishpod.
Yes. So three ways to reach us: email, Instagram, and Twitter. Once again, just thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.